This is How the World Works. I am Kevin Williamson. This is a place where we have conversations about work and the meaning of life. Oddly enough, we've got a guy here who wrote a book with a subtext, a subtitle rather, that is Work and the Meaning of Life. Please welcome my old friend David Bahnsen, who is the author of Full Time, a very interesting book about work, which I very much enjoyed reading. And David does other stuff in life. He is a finance muckety-muck kind of guy who plays with money and does things I don't understand. And we were colleagues at National Review, and David, I believe, is still on the board maybe of National Review over there, and does all sorts of interesting stuff. So welcome.
Well, thanks, Kevin. Good to be with you.
Normally, I ask people about their first job, their worst job, that sort of thing. And I'll get to you, get to that with you here in a bit. But why don't I do my my Jonah Goldberg impersonation and say, what's your book about?
Yes, our favorite question these days. Well, when the book is called Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life, it'd be hard to deny that I'm writing a book about work being the meaning of life. And so it is one of those titles that hopefully begs for people to ask for explanation. Like, you can't possibly be saying work is more important than fill in the blank. And what I'm getting at is that work is the meaning of life in the sense that I believe God made us for the purpose of work, and that there is a universal truth about humanity. There are a lot of things that are generalizations, a lot of things that are often true, but there is a particular thing that I believe to be universally true about every single human being God ever let walk through the door, and that is that they were made in his image. That all mankind are image bearers of God. And what I try to do in the book is make the argument that what this means is directly attached to mankind's capacity for work, for productivity, that that is the unique image-bearing characteristic of God that we share and therefore ought to inform the way we think about work even today in the modern economy.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people, when they come to this book and seeing your background as an investment guy, they're going to expect a kind of economic treatise. But you've written something that's much more directly a religious book and a book about the the meaning of life in a much larger and what's the word I'm looking for? Less economic sense than people probably expecting. Can you tell me a little bit about your background on those issues? So where do you come from on that? And maybe a little about your father, who, as I understand, was an interesting theologian.
Yeah, the book's dedicated to him. And he is kind of at the center of this because, first of all, just my own work ethic and my beliefs and about the character of work I got from him. He was the hardest working a person I ever saw. And even though he was working in a field that was more scholarly and academic, he was a Christian intellectual. But because he died at age 47, the output he had in his life, a lot of people could die at 87 and you look at their output and it might be not as impressive as it should be because you just figure over, 60 years of writing and speaking, they had a lot of time to do this output, where I think my dad got 60 years of output in to, about 20 or 25 adult years. And so he's a key figure in this, but for other reasons as well, we'll get to in a moment. My own background is that I do work in economics and finance for a living. I run a private wealth management firm that manages over $5 billion of client capital. And I spent most of my career before starting my own firm on Wall Street. I was a managing director at Morgan Stanley.
Can I ask you what may sound like a dumb question?
Of course.
Is $5 billion a big fund?
Well, it's not a fund. This is individual.
Is it a big operation?
And so, yes, it's quite big. We'd be, as far as independent, what they call RIAs, registered investment advisors, as far as independents go, we'd be one of the larger. Now, it used to be that once you got to 1 billion, it was pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. There's a gazillion of them out there that are managing 70 million, 90 million, 100 million, that are more usually kind of mom and pop type independent shops. But I think 1 billion has now become 3 billion and 3 billion has become 5. There are a lot, too, that will manage over 10 billion, but they tend to have been what we call inorganic, that they were M&A. They bought a few different companies and merged them together, where ours has been very, very organic. So it's a big number. But when you look at the tire independent space, it's trillions of dollars. So it's just, there's a lot of money out there.
You know, just not to go off on a tangent here, but when it comes to particularly finance, but just the sort of modern American economy in general, I find it increasingly difficult to really get a real gut appreciation for the scale of the numbers. There are so many billionaires in the United States you've never heard of. Yeah. Just, you know, some guy who started a company and sold it and then started another one and sold it. And just the number of just very, very wealthy people one comes across who are not, well, I was CEO of General Motors or something like that. Well, I guess the CEO of General Motors maybe isn't that wealthy, but by at least automotive CEO standards these days, who knows? But anyway, that's something that just hits my head. You know, you see these billions and hundreds of millions thrown around, and sometimes it's just it's difficult to get an appreciation for them, really.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, even the example you use, that it used to be in the 50s and 60s, most of the wealthiest people in the country were likely CEOs or you know, real C-suite type muckety mucks at Fortune 100 companies, mm-hmm. where now, unless they were a founder who had a sale event, you know, brought it public and still run it. So your Bezoses and Musks and whatnot were founders that now have multi-billion dollar wealth. But the idea of someone being hired as a CEO and accumulating $1 billion of wealth, a Jamie Dimon, it's extremely rare.
And yeah, that's an interesting point that I think maybe is underappreciated about the way our economy actually works, is that you can make a lot of money in a job, but you don't become, you know, one of these super yacht owning, flying into space guys from having a job. You really only make that money from starting a business.
Yeah. Entrepreneurialism is still by far the path to the greatest amount of wealth. But of course, that's proportionate to the greatest likelihood of failure as well. It's funny, back in the 80s, this was the kind of thing not only Gordon Gekko in the movie Wall Street was specifically targeting, his famous greed is good speech, which, by the way, until that line was a masterpiece of a speech. But with the Carl Icahns and T. Boone Pickens and some of these corporate raiders of the 80s, that's what they were going after. Is that the managers of these businesses didn't own any of them. They quote unquote had no skin in the game, as Nassim Taleb would say. I don't think you can give people options, stock options and shares in stock, and have them manage it the same as if they bought stock in the company. Yeah. You know, having downside risk makes it more symmetrical.
You just mentioned Boone Pickens, and every time his name comes up, I'm just reminded that I thought I was going to literally get into a fight with him one time in a National Review staff meeting, where he was up pitching his, you know, Pickens plan to require everybody to buy the natural gas that he owned a whole lot of. And I was poking fun of him a little bit about it and kind of pouring a little cold water on it. And he must have been in his 80s at the time.
Yeah.
And he just went into a rage. He was about to come up out of his chair. And I thought I was about to get punched in the face by some 80-year-old man. But on the other hand, there's not a lot of charming stuff that's really ever happened on Twitter. But one of my favorite Twitter moments ever was Drake, the musician. I think it was Drake. Yeah, it was Drake. Doing a thing that people do, which is weird, was sort of boasting about his wealth on social media. And I believe what he tweeted was, "The first 100 million is always the hardest." And of all people, Boone Pickens responded to him. And his response was, "First billion's a hell of a lot harder."
Yeah.
which I liked. But we were talking about your religious background.
Yeah. So I think that entering finance is not a space. There's a lot of people that maybe came to Wall Street and maybe they had an evangelical background, or they got saved on Wall Street. Certainly after 9/11, Tim Keller's Faith and Work ministry out of Redeemer Church mm-hmm. became a big deal. But I don't think there's a lot of people on Wall Street that were either cursed or blessed, depending on how you look at it, with this like deep philosophical and theological background that being the son of Greg Bahnsen kind of forced me to have. And so I've never really believed that my theological life and my economic and financial life, which, by the way, I would also tie into socio-political and so forth, I don't really view them as all that differentiated. I am so anti-dualist, so anti a sacred secular distinction, then in a lot of ways, apart from the obvious pay scale differences, I really do believe that when I get up every day and go work to steward client capital, that I'm doing the same thing in the kingdom that my dad was doing, getting up and writing sermons or lectures or otherwise ministering in the way he was. So that kind of drove a lot of what I believe about this book, this really thorough disdain for a distinction between the sacred and secular. And that's how largely I've tried to understand my financial life as well. I think that there are different principles I believe in, and I try to apply them and what I think about client capital, what I think about macroeconomics. And this is inseparable for me from my religious beliefs.
So your dad didn't make a big pile of money in the theology business?
He did not, nor did he make a big pile of money by dying at age 47. So it was a perfect combination of lack of longevity and lack of affluence that unfortunately, you know, started off my young adult life. What he did, though, for me financially was far more profound. He didn't make a pile of money. But I think that he instilled that work ethic that was very useful for me in the money I've been able to make in my life.
Yeah, I've met some very wealthy ministers, but maybe that's not exactly going about it the right way.
Yeah, and they probably were not ordained in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church.
Probably not, no. Levity aside, though, I'm always interested in that issue that, you know, you and I are both people who I think you describe yourself as being anti-dualist, and maybe that's a good way to think of it all. I do think of myself as having maybe two independent tracks of how I look at the world sometimes, which is that markets are really good for answering economic questions, but there are lots of questions out there that aren't economic questions. Yeah. And there are people out there who do absolutely important, vital, irreplaceable work in fields that just don't pay a lot. And this strikes a lot of people, I think, who see the world politically different from the way you and I see it, as being either unjust or irrational, or, you know, why does this guy who does something that I don't understand or maybe even approve of make so much money? Why does this basketball player make $100 million a year, whereas the school teacher doesn't? And aren't the teachers doing more important work, and shouldn't they make more money? So when people come to you with those sorts of questions or those sorts of objections, how do you answer them?
No, see, I start off by acknowledging that I think it's a reasonable prima facie question that if I'm making the statement, which I am, that God is no respecter of persons and that he looks at the corner office law firm partner or the corner office Wall Street guy the same as he looks at a shoe cobbler or a suit tailor, that there is a category distinction. That there is nothing in the dignity of work. Pope John Paul II wrote an absolutely masterful encyclical about work in the late 1970s called Laborum Exercens. And he makes the point that work is that the value of work is subjective, meaning the subject of work is the worker. And so if I believe that the value of work is coming from the dignity of the image bearer of God doing the work, then I cannot make a distinction between that value in God's eyes for a finance guy and a busboy. But there is nothing I just said that trumps market forces or to use a Hayekian term, price discovery. So within the value that God sees in work, there then is also here on earth the need for price discovery to allow for economic calculation, to allow for new production of goods and services, which I argue is the entire point of us being here on earth, is that we are out stewarding the resources of the earth, co-creating with God as his image bearer. You eliminate prices from that, you eliminate the whole kit and caboodle. And I think that what we get hung up on is that in market forces, we've decided George Clooney's worth $25 million for a movie, and we've decided the busboy is worth, let's call it $10 an hour, and that can seem to be unequal. And it is unequal if you define that as not the same, because $10 and $25 million are indeed not the same. It is not unequal in that they both were equally a byproduct of market forces. What can become unequal is the imposition of something other than price discovery, the laws of supply and demand and subjective values that get us to a place of price discovery. And so if the state were to decide George Clooney must be paid this, the busboy must be paid that, then I think you get something unequal. You're getting an intervention that did not apply to all sorts of other professions or occupations or people or circumstances. So it isn't something that is easy to swallow. All of us are likely to use the kind of offhand vocabulary sometimes. That guy's not worth, you know, some eighth man on the New York Knicks who scores 3 points a game. And you say, that guy's not worth $70 million over the next 3 years. There's a sense in which we're right. Like, we don't think he's earning his keep, but what we don't mean is that the price discovery that got to that point should be discarded. And so I just make a very key, what Kuiper would call a sphere distinction between the value of work in God's eyes and the market force pricing of work.
Yeah. You know, I've written a lot about poverty and drug addiction, things like that, and a lot of the dysfunction associated with what we call, for lack of a better term, the white working class. And a term I don't like for a couple of reasons. One, I don't necessarily think that there's anything that's very specific to white people in that set of problems. But the other more important part of that, that I think gets that the term gets wrong, is that it isn't really largely a set of dysfunctions associated with the working class. It's associated with a non-working class, with people who are in long-term unemployment. I don't want to fall into that, you know, libertarian rhetorical trap and error of pretending that everything is rosy for relatively low skill, low income workers. It's not, but there is a lot of opportunity out there. For instance, I've probably shared more of my personal biography in the last couple of months than I should have, but I can tell you, for instance, that the going rate for overnight babysitters in Dallas, Texas, can you guess what it is?
Well, I bet it's triple what we would have guessed back, you know, when we were younger.
So at the high end, it's about $60 an hour.
Yeah.
And so that's a reasonable wage. I've been working for a long time before I made that much money. You know, you mentioned earlier as examples of your contrast to Wall Street people, cobblers and tailors. But you're going to have to find some different examples because those people actually make pretty good money these days.
That's right.
In fact, there was a wonderful interview I saw a couple of months ago with a guy who does. He is a sneaker customizer, and he's also a guy who, I guess, produces like sort of one-off sets of sneakers for people. And the interviewer referred to him as a cobbler, and he corrected him. He said, no, cobbler repairs shoes. I manufacture shoes. Yeah. I'm a cordwainer. And which I thought was great, but he probably makes a few $100,000 a year. You know, it's pretty good business. I wrote a piece a couple of years ago about a guy who makes high-end kitchen knives. He's started off as a one-man shop. He's got a couple of employees now who I don't know how much money he makes, but I bet it's a lot because his knives go for $1,500, $1,600 a piece. And on the other hand, you've got people who are living in areas that are often relatively prosperous, but they tend to have narrow centers of prosperity. Like, so my hometown of Lubbock, Texas is a good example of this. Lubbock is a relatively decently well-off place. It's got a decent local economy and all that, but it's really focused on Texas Tech University. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have some connection to that, or you're not a doctor or a lawyer or something like that, the means of the path of upward prosperity is really very difficult to sort out for yourself. I mean, there are entrepreneurs there and people who start businesses like there are anywhere else. You see this in a lot of college towns, particularly in the poorer parts of the country, in the South and Southwest. You see it to a lesser extent because it's been sort of economically sorted out in these kind of former factory towns where there was one big employer in town. So there were a lot of people that did reasonably well, and then a lot of people who weren't attached to that, who didn't do very well at all. And that's really where I see the most serious and intense of that kind of social dysfunction concentrated is in people who either are in long-term unemployment, sometimes intergenerational unemployment. Mm-hmm. I interviewed a guy in the Bronx a few years ago who was in his 40s and had never really had a job. And what was interesting to me was that he didn't really know men who had had jobs. He knew a lot of women who'd had jobs. His mother had a job. His father didn't. And that was just sort of normal for his community and his, you know, his experience. So is it, you think that, that the experience of work and being in a job and doing the things that are necessary to be economically productive keep you out of that sort of dysfunction? Or is it the other way around, that if you've got the sort of character that's going to steer you away from those sorts of things, that you're also the kind of person who ends up getting a job and being economically self-sufficient?
My answer is yes.
Okay.
I think that this is maybe one of the most profound examples of what will either be a negative feedback loop or a virtuous cycle in one's life. But I do very much believe that most people who are employable are marryable, and most people who are marryable are employable, and that the removal of one of those ends up leading to the removal of the other in many cases. The issue of long-term unemployment is very much the problem that you stated is. The only thing that I've noticed is that there is no long-term unemployment before there is short-term unemployment. And in other words, the surefire way to make sure that one of these men doesn't end up going 10 years without real actual work is for them to not go 10 months or I would recommend as much as possible 10 weeks. Now, there are circumstances in someone's life where they cannot find a job for 10 weeks. But what I'm suggesting is that there not be a 10-week period where they're not looking for a job. That that one who is in a short-term unemployment predicament, to avoid it becoming long-term unemployment. And you're right, there's often a cultural milieu around it. The examples, the infrastructure they've had, the family environment or lack of family environment. But to break the cycle, one who is short-term unemployed, making their job, the search for a job, the search for opportunity, the kind of unpacking of any type of network or connection they may have, their long-lost uncle who they haven't talked to much but has a business, if they'll just simply move a couple states away to take an entry-level minimum wage job. These things that can result in some short-term employment are the surest fire antibody to long-term unemployment that we've ever seen.
How many times have you moved for a job in your life?
It's a real bad example. No one's going to like it because in a sense, I've moved to New York City from a life being in Southern California. But I did that because I wanted to and was expanding a business. It's a little different than I've lost a job. I'm down and out. I got to go move and uproot my family for a job. So I just haven't had that predicament in my life where I've needed to do it. But my childhood was filled with it. My father was a professor at a seminary in Jackson, Mississippi, after finishing his doctoral work at USC. So he was a born and raised Southern California guy. I was born at USC. And next thing I know, we're in Mississippi. He gets fired, goes to Atlanta, teaches there for a minute, ends up back in Southern California. So there was movement in a station wagon with kids, with $117, you know, in the bank. That was a real life reality for my dad. And I think it was much more common when you and I were kids that people had to move for jobs. It still happens today. But I think two things at once about that, Kevin. I think on one hand, it's good. It doesn't have to happen as much, that there are more professions that don't necessarily require it. A lot of that is digital. But I also think that there's a lot of people that won't move, and that limited mobility or dynamism is a huge part in our labor force right now.
One of my little pet policy ideas is that it might be useful to repackage some portion of unemployment benefits as relocation benefits.
Yeah.
And to maybe create incentives for employers to help people to relocate. I can remember a couple of times when I have had to move for a job and have done so under, you know, sort of economic duress. You know, it wasn't hiring the white glove moving service, and you know, it was stretching to figure out how to put a deposit on an apartment that was not a very nice apartment, and you know, getting there on your last 5 gallons of gas, sort of thing. I suspected a little bit of incentive in that direction. And I had a lot more resources than most people do, especially people, a lot of people who are relocating for a job like that. It's a lot harder for other people. And I was single at the time. I didn't have, you know, wife or kids or anything like that. So do you think that's a workable thing? Do you think it would make much difference?
Well, I do. I know it's workable. I mean, for one thing, we already have the mechanism that they're already from Federal Treasury giving money. And of course, from the state unemployment is really where the bulk of these coffers come. And so whether you want to use the state or Fed to administer, I'd prefer it be done at the state level. But then it gets a little tricky because California might be paying benefits for someone to relocate to Illinois or something like that.
I guarantee you no one is relocating to Illinois for a job.
Yeah. Sometimes you use an analogy and a second later you realize you probably could have picked one of the other 49 states.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though. Actually, California has net negative migration right now.
Yeah.
And the only other two states in the country that joined them with that are Louisiana and Mississippi. So most would probably think that your New York's and Illinois are having net migration and not the state that arguably has the best weather in the world. But no, California is leading the pack there. So,
yikes. Yeah, it's got to be the first time in, it's been the case recently, but, you know, for most of human history, people were going to California.
Yeah.
And certainly for most of American history, people were going to California. That is a real tragedy. You and I should have a separate conversation sometime about the California situation because you're from there. I'm not, but I love the state and I wish it well. And I hope that it would be better governed at some point than it currently is. So what was your work life like before you're doing what you're doing now? What kind of jobs did you have when you were a youngster? Did you work when you were in high school or in summers, things like that?
Yeah, so it was kind of a fun thing I did in the new book is each chapter I start off with a little kind of like opening box showing the jobs I had over the years. And my very first one was 12 years old. I started mowing lawns in our neighborhood. And that was a byproduct of the Commodore 64 computer. That if you didn't want one, there was something wrong with you. And if you didn't have one, there might have been something wrong with you. My friends had one and I didn't. The difference is that their parents bought them one and my dad was not going to buy me one. But he did say I could have one. He just said I had to pay for it. So I started mowing lawns and all that kind of stuff throughout my neighborhood. And I'd walk around the neighborhood with a briefcase and a lawnmower. And the briefcase was there presumably to collect a check or something and put it inside. I don't even really know, but it made me feel a little bit more like Alex P. Keaton, which was my role model. So I did get a Commodore 64 computer. And then the first job I got that had FICA withholdings and other things like that, I was passing out fruit smoothie samplers at the food court at our local mall, which was actually quite a very nice mall.
What mall was that?
It was a Fashion Island. So I lived in Irvine, but this was in Newport Beach. So I had to take a bus to get to the mall. But I did that for a bit. And then I had probably the best job I've had ever since was an usher at a movie theater. And you work opening weekend of Pretty Woman and Die Hard 2. You're pretty much ready for everything. And I handled that. cleaning a movie theater floor after, you know, a sold out show, people have no idea. People are generally pretty disgusting to begin with, but you add butter.
Butter normally makes things better, but I guess there are a few situations in life you can actually make worse.
Yes.
And you mentioning ushers, you know, I don't normally lean into the Texas thing too hard. You know, I did grow up in West Texas and all that, but I was an usher at rodeos when I was a kid, and that wasn't a terrible job. That was all right, actually.
Yeah.
So you were a movie theater usher. What did you do when you were in college? Did you work while you were in school?
And so my dad passed away my freshman year and I left school and never went back and had to begin life. My mom was already gone. Dad died and no money. And that's really kind of the key catalyst to everything is.
And you were 18?
I was 20. Yeah.
20. Okay.
And I think survival is a very good motivator. I had friends who were in a band and I started working with them to kind of help their band out. and ended up managing about six or seven bands, opened an office in Nashville, was a booking agent for some, you know, really large bands. I mean, ended up selling a couple million records. So it's kind of almost impossible to do this justice, but from age 20 to 27, I basically got my college degree and MBA by starting a business that I had no business starting and making a few bucks and developing way more self-confidence than any young man should. But it was the substitute for therapy for, you know, after losing my dad, who like anyone losing their dad, presumably if they have a good relationship, they'd be affected. But I mean, he was like my best friend. I mean, we were as close as could be. And so I lost my mentor and father and my, you know, source of kind of financial stability, academic direction, just sort of life direction. And so that that period managing bands and sort of just growing as a person and building that kind of self-confidence, starting to make a few bucks and feeling pretty good about myself for doing so. This was in the early and mid 90s. People may remember the stock market wasn't doing too badly at that time. And then all of a sudden I realized I have a path to go. I wanted to go to college to get a degree so I could go work in finance. I can go do it on my own. And I sold the company. I got engaged and I began in the training program at a firm called Payne Weber that ended up selling to UBS my rookie year there. And that's kind of how I got into finance in my later 20s.
Right now, everyone listening wants to know who the bands were.
Everyone listening what?
Wants to know who the bands were.
Oh, well, I booked some tours for a band called Sixpence None the Richer, which had the number one biggest song in America back then in the 90s called Kiss Me. But the bands I managed were called the Supertones and Plank Eye and Staves Acre. I also booked a couple tours for a band called POD that sold about 6 million records later on. So it was just a big time for faith-based artists, Christian-oriented. It was a movement that didn't fit me well. I'm not a musician and I don't really like musicians. And I think you talk about dualism.
Why don't you like musicians?
I have made it a point in my life for the last 25 years to not manage anyone's money where I care about their money more than they do.
Very good. Very good. That's a fair point. So talk to me more about work as therapy.
Sorry about that. The sun was hitting me. Say that again, Kevin.
Talk to me more about work as therapy.
Yeah, I think that this may be somewhat controversial for some people, and I wish it wasn't, but I do make the argument that work has certain cathartic or therapeutic benefits to it. And then I hear pop psychologists say, well, this is dangerous. It's just a diversion. Creating a distraction is not a substitute for really coping with things. And my point is, first of all, yes, it can be. Second of all, it's not binary. There is nothing that says you can't think through different issues you want to think through while having the distraction and diversion of something like work. But third and most importantly, I think that the way in which most people get through difficult times is through something that is itself productive. And if the diversion is something that is unproductive, it seems rather uncontroversial to say that will not suffice. The most common examples are men that become big womanizers or people who fall into substance abuse issues. Those things strike me as rather obviously unhealthy diversions, and work has never struck me as an unhealthy diversion. So someone putting themselves to work in the business of meeting the needs of others, getting paid to do so, feeling the self-satisfaction that comes from an earned success, all of these things are inherently therapeutic, and my argument is they are so by design. The therapeutic benefit of them comes from the fact that they are the activities God made us to do. So there's an ontological benefit. The being of mankind is not to merely sit and float and to be a passive participant in life. That work essentially puts us into an active framework that is inherently beneficial to our mental well-being. So this represented one of the catalysts to me writing the book is out of the COVID moment. I can't remember if it was the Atlantic or New Yorker or one of these, you know, the type, obviously, but some person who makes a pretty
never good heard living, of that magazine.
Yeah. makes a pretty good living, has a pretty good job. As you well know, you got to be a pretty good writer to get hired at the Atlantic, in my opinion. And someone writing, and may not have been the Atlantic, it could have been New Yorker, but it was one of these elite, very well-respected, you know, significant publications, writing a book about how awful it was that everybody was so into their jobs. And that is the type of don't preach what I practice hypocrisy that Charles Murray called out in Coming Apart that drives me utterly bonkers. People with fulfilling careers, fulfilling lives, deservedly so. Presumably they're talented and worked hard and gifted. And then writing a piece from the platform of a fulfilling career to talk about how overrated work is. It's just simply sickening to me. This is the kind of place right now where the church and the world are very much aligned, that work is a problem getting in the way of our well-being. And the world would define it differently than the church would. I think many in the church would argue work is getting in the way of us being better family members or better church members. And the world probably wouldn't go that route. But one way or the other, from secular pop psychology to most Sunday morning sermons, and here I'm probably picking on evangelicalism more than Catholic social thought. In both cases, I think they're dead wrong. I think work is a solution, not the problem.
Yeah. I have a kind of thing I go back to from time to time, which is that there are two very different ways of looking at people. And to put it in, you know, kind of cold economic terms, you can look at people as liabilities or people as assets. And I like to look at people as assets, as being inherently valuable, their time being inherently valuable, their effort, their energy, their intelligence being valuable. The more typical, I think, political way of looking at people is as a liability. They're a problem to be solved. And I think this sometimes leads us into an unhealthy, shallow, and superficial way of thinking about employment. Because if you listen to, you know, Joe Biden, typical politician, talking about a job, what a job is it solves the problem of this person. So the purpose of the job is to give this person an income so he can provide for his family and to give him health benefits and that sort of stuff. And it leaves out the whole question of his productivity, of what he actually does. So from a certain point of view, a kind of, you know, welfare status point of view, if we could think of a way just to give people jobs that would be economically sustainable, that would give them decent incomes and, you know, benefits and that kind of stuff, it wouldn't matter what they produced. It wouldn't matter what they did as long as there was some sort of economic mechanism to make this work. And I think that, of course, is exactly the wrong way to think about things. And at the same time, I think there is a little bit of make workism behind some of the conservative criticisms of the welfare state, some of the proposals for work requirements for certain kinds of social benefits are not really oriented toward creating real value. They're sort of more of a paternalistic thing of, well, we need to get this person out of bed and going to an office or doing something every day. And there is some value to that, too. Mm-hmm. But it leaves out the basic question, or the really what seems to be the fundamental issue, that the point of work isn't even the income that the worker gets or the satisfaction he gets or the dignity he gets from having a job. Economically, the point of work is what he produces. And it seems to me that in our policy discussion, in our policy thinking, we often really don't pay enough attention to that question. You'll hear, you know, politicians talk about, well, we need to create jobs. Well, no, you don't need to create jobs. What you need to do is create, period, you know, create some sort of value, and the jobs come from that. How do we go about working that truth and that insight into our policy discussions?
I think you've kind of highlighted what my biggest concern is with my friends and brethren that are what I would refer to as kind of secular defenders of a market economy, that are willing, they're in the Milton Friedman or Friedrich Hayek camp, that are basically the leading intellectuals producing the leading arguments for why we believe in a free economy. And out of that, we want the jobs that come from it, all that good stuff, but they are not rooting it to the same anthropology I am. So what I think what your comment does is unpack the fact that a job is not the end, it's a means, right? Like, we're not doing it so there will be jobs. There is some activity that is to be done, a production of goods and services that meet the needs and wants of humanity. And that in order to produce goods and services that meet needs and wants of humanity, particularly at scale, there is some sense of employment that comes in. There's the use of labor. I would also argue the use of capital, right? Well, that to me has to be made clear. The economic way of thinking contra Keynesianism is not a job for the sake of job. It's not digging a ditch for the sake of digging a ditch. That there is some useful activity going on and that our focus needs to be there. But where I want to take it further in my life's work is reminding people that the taking it further, why we want to produce goods and services, is itself connected to something more transcendent than merely productivity, GDP, job creation, any economic integer, that even then it is really inseparable from mankind as an image bearer of God. The reason I want to produce goods and services and is not only because I want jobs to be created and because I want this meaningful good and service to come from it, but all of those things are connected to the aspiration for human flourishing. And that for me is rooted to my view of reality, my view of human nature, my view of the relationship between a creator and his creatures.
Now, you said something just now that made me think of an earlier exchange I had with someone. I had written something about gains in productivity over the last several decades, and particularly relating to investments in information technology and that sort of thing. And someone responded, well, you know, who captured the economic benefits of those gains in productivity? It certainly wasn't the workers. It's not true, for one thing. But even if it were true, they're not the ones who made the investment. You know, there are, as you mentioned, there are two halves to this. There's capital and there's labor. There are people who work in factories and there are people who raise the money and take the economic risk to build the factories. And both of these things are important. And because one kind of work is, I think, more visible to people and more common to our experience, we tend to think of that as what work really means. Whereas people would think of what you do and on 9 days out of 10, what I do is not really being work at all. It's being some other sort of thing. It's well, if they don't like what you do, they would call it a grift or a scam. If they do like what you do, they would call it a calling or a career or something like that.
But I think that what the notion of, like, your point about the welfare state, the right has sort of, you know, I kind of am half-what sympathetic to it, about that there's a benefit to just getting someone out of bed and making them go to work. And you could call it paternalistic, but sometimes it sounds even kind of punitive, right? Like, you know, we're going to let you have dessert, but we're going to make you eat your supper first. And I actually think that's all good. If a man won't work, he shouldn't eat. You know, I get that. But it's an incomplete argument. What I'd like to say is the reason I want people to work before they receive benefits is because I think they were made in the image of God. And I believe that they share a dignity that the rest of creation does not share. That God made that person very good, where he merely made the rest of his creation good. And in this elevated, dignified status that bears the image and likeness of God, I don't believe, as apparently you more materialistic people do, I don't believe that about half of us are supposed to be productive and go to work and do things and the other half are not. The same soul-filling activities that so many people who have happy lives have done, I'd like it to be available for these people as well. And in the meantime, have their material needs meet. We talk safety net. We talk about the daily provisions and the more pragmatic components. But the right anchoring a critique of the welfare state to, first of all, a policy of work requirement, but secondly, a work requirement that is rooted in something more transcendent and even spiritual, I think is an extremely compelling message.
I think it is too. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who don't see the world religiously the way you do or I do. And presumably, people like us want to bring our more sort of secular-minded colleagues into a coalition. Yep. We want to convince them that our policy preferences are the right ones, or that they're at least pointed in the right direction. So what do you say to people who say, you know, David, I think you've got an intelligent and deeply humane view of the world, but I just don't buy this religious stuff. And if you're going to tell me we have to do X because these workers are made in the image of God, or these potential workers are made in the image of God, I'm just not going to buy that argument. Do you say, well, here, I've got some other arguments? Or do you say, well, ultimately, we just got a basic difference in the way we see the world, and we're never going to be able to bridge that?
Well, if the objective is coalitional, as you started off saying, then I'm perfectly content to frame my argument without compromising the truth claims that are embedded in it with language that I think would be very hard for people to deny. So what I would say to someone who says, I'm not religious, after they get done saying such a religious thing like that to me, I would say, do you believe that mankind has dignity? Or do you really believe they're merely atomistic? Do you think kicking a kid is the same thing as kicking a rock? And they're always going to acknowledge, even if they don't root the dignity of mankind into creational norms like I do, they're at least going to acknowledge the conclusion, even if we have different premises. And at that point, for coalition purposes, I don't need them to join my premises. No. Now, for purposes of squaring the circle, of really completing a kind of complete worldview about it, then yes, I'm never going to compromise on why I believe what I believe. But that isn't necessary to form a coalition. So to the extent that someone says, hey, I want to enhance our welfare argument too, I don't really get into the God stuff, but you said something about mankind being important and not being just a mere consumer, having productive capacity. And I'm perfectly happy to frame the argument along those lines. But between you and me, Kevin, I think they're incoherent arguments if they aren't tethered to creational truth, but that's just me.
Yeah. You know, years ago, when I was a young newspaper editor outside of Philadelphia, and there was a guy I knew who was a wealthy local guy, and he had this gigantic house, this big, beautiful house in Gladwin, Pennsylvania, if you know Gladwin, which is one of the wealthiest zip codes in the country. And it wasn't my kind of house, but it was a very impressive house. And I was talking to him, and I was like, I'm just curious, you know, what does a guy have to do to earn enough money to buy a house like this? I don't want to buy this house, but I'd like to be economically in a place where that were an option for me in life. I'd do something else with the money. And he said, well, Kevin, you know what I do? I'm the president of XYZ Bank. And I said, I know what your job title is. You know, I know where you work. I have no idea what you do. David, what does your workday look like? What do you do when you're not doing all the other things you're doing that aren't related to your business?
Well, keep in mind that right now I have 63 employees. We have 7 offices. And so the job that I'm about to explain in year 25 of this career is quite a bit different than in year 1. And so somebody who wants to enter financial services is not going to have a similar day to what I'm doing now. I'm working harder now, or as hard as I ever have. But I have research analysts that work for me. I have traders that work for me. I went years and years doing every trade myself, let alone originating the trade, meaning thinking of what it is we wanted to execute on behalf of a client and then actually executing it on a trading desk. Now we have people in our business that are able to do some of these tasks. So we have a better division of labor, more efficiency. But my primary role today is making the decisions about how we want to allocate client capital and then overseeing my business. And so I have leaders and managers I have to direct. I'm talking to clients every single day. I'm talking to prospective clients on behalf of my advisors most days. I'm kind of out of the rainmaking and business development side, but I'm supporting others. But then we have really built our business around a point of view, thought leadership. So the whole taboo of don't talk about religion or politics, I think it's probably good advice for a lot of people, but I don't think it's because it's wrong to talk about religion or politics. I think it's good advice not to talk about it because most people don't know what the hell they're talking about, or they can't express it without being uncharitable. I try, even in this Trumpy moment, to be charitable and to just talk about what I believe about the Fed, about the economy, about socio-political matters. And some people like it, some people don't, and it attracts a certain people to our business. In the meantime, the day-to-day manager of the business, I have to make sure we have the best estate planners, tax planners, all the various, you know, components of a high-end private wealth business. So I'm doing that day in and day out. When it's interesting, when you talk about that, sometimes what it means to be a president of a bank is not immediately clear. We know a title, but we don't know the role. I'm not sure there's any industry that that's more true of than finance or the term Wall Street.
Yes.
The amount of business students that will say, I want to go to Wall Street. And I'll say, what area? And they say, I don't know, maybe like an investment banker. And I'll say, what does that mean? And they go, I have no idea. In business school. And so being able to differentiate the difference between private wealth, between an asset manager, a hedge fund, private equity, and not to mention commercial banking. I don't think very many people understand what banking is, to be honest. And just sort of what the process of a deposit collecting institution that lends money out fractionally to try to collect net interest margin. These are businesses that then feed to capital market activity in the economy. And connecting all those dots, I think, is super important for someone entering finance. I guess I'm just sort of saying this anecdotally because it kind of amazes me how many really smart people don't understand the basic vocabulary of finance.
Yeah, I think this is it's a political problem as well. You know, one of the reasons I think that there is so much hostility, which ends up shaping policy in bad ways toward the financial services industry, is because it's just opaque to people.
Yeah.
There's somebody out there doing something I don't understand. It makes a lot of money, and it's called a hedge fund, and the word hedge makes it sound shady.
Yeah.
And it just feels wrong to people. And I don't think that we sort of, you know, liberty movement people do a very good job of explaining to people the role that finance plays in the more familiar, ordinary, quote unquote, real economy. That if you're going to be someone who opens a car dealership or builds a laundromat or starts some other kind of business, that finance is going to be an extremely important part of that in a lot of cases. And that it's going to, in some cases, be the difference between, you know, a business that really thrives and makes it and one that doesn't. You know, I was talking to an acquaintance the other day who's a, you know, real estate guy. And, you know, we were talking through what he was working on in his project. And it was pretty clear that you could take his exact same project, you know, build it the same way, but with a different set of, you know, financial models behind it and a different set of financial decisions. And one of these projects would do really well and be profitable, and one of them probably wouldn't. And it really just has to do with how you handle organizing the money that comes through it and how you structure the debt and all the rest of it. And people's eyes start to glaze over a little bit when you talk about those things. But it is important, I think, for people to understand that, yeah, there's a real dignified, important, traditional kind of work that consists of going to a place and doing a thing, you know, going to a factory and building this thing. But these things don't come out of nowhere. They are not, you know, ex nihilated. And at the back of all this somewhere, there's some banker, you know, or someone who's banker adjacent.
Yeah. And even if it isn't a banker, which some people may get more technical and maybe they're following you and they say, well, that's my problem is that the banker is putting depositor money into the venture. And there's all sorts of things that could be said about that. But whether it's a banker or venture capital, private equity, private debt, at some point, there is a need for capital. And that capital can either be only from people who can't afford to lose it, or it can be from people who can take risk. And if you want to live in an economy where the only capital that is expended into new businesses, new ventures, and so forth is from those who can't afford to lose it, then you will see very quickly why you miss Wall Street and why you miss capital markets. It would make for the most medieval of cultures, very primitive lifestyle, very, very quickly. So I think that you're exactly right. We haven't explained it well, but I think a lot of the people that you would think would normally be responsible to explain it made themselves not understand it. Even when we talked about, like before, why work is important, and somebody understanding that at some level, they may not think their job is meaningful. They may not like it. It may feel remedial. But there is some production of goods and services that meet the needs of humanity going on in your role, or nobody will pay you. You are not getting paid to dig a ditch for no reason. And so just as much as I want people to understand that when they are a busboy or a maid at a hotel or a corner office lawyer, that there is some value creation taking place at some level, subject to price discovery, subject to market forces, what have you, that capital is playing in the same realm, in the same universe. And so I am responsible to steward client capital, whereby I have their needs met. The person who owns or holds capital, their needs can only be met by meeting the needs of someone else. In that case, normally a producer, but that producer can only have their needs met by meeting the needs of someone else, generally a consumer. So whereas a non-capital intensive business is going to have a producer who makes goods or services that meets needs of somebody else, there's two people benefiting. All capital does is bring in someone else who enhances the needs being met of the producer, who enhances the needs being met of the consumer. There's ways that this structure could be cleaned up and articulated perhaps more succinctly than I am now, but it isn't that complicated. But the capital markets, as a necessary component of meeting needs and services and facilitating the needs and services of both risk takers and the end users of the products of risk takers, this is how capital ought to be explained: capital markets, finance, Wall Street. What your point is, it's entirely understood as a derision, as a class warfare term. It's a rich guy who I don't like. That's what Wall Street is understood to be. That's why bankers, hedge funds, private equity, which in my world, it's sort of like you meet a lawyer and he does like divorce law and you start asking him about litigation or estate planning and that, like, they don't know anything. Sure. You know, to me, private equity and a commercial banker are as different as a waiter and a plumber. But in the caricature that both the right and the left in this populist moment, I'm not sure that the right is any more approving of capital markets than the left is. And that is to our shame.
Yeah, they suddenly discovered that Wall Street's in New York City. Yeah. And that a lot of the people who work there are New York guys who don't share the kind of cultural values of Oklahoma in many cases.
Yeah.
Setting aside the kind of big macroeconomic policy questions, I think maybe you and I have some disagreements about the Fed and some other things. But what's one big policy change you would make from the point of view of encouraging work and encouraging labor markets to perform in the way we want them to?
Yeah, but I doubt we do have much daylight on the Fed. From the stuff I've read of you about the Fed, I've been very sympathetic to it. I think that that where it comes to work and productivity, I'm of the opinion that I don't want the central bank to divert resources from productive activity. And I think that excessive intervention helps to do that. But there's kind of like two categories. There's those who want the Fed to kind of master plan all this and those who don't. And then within those who don't, there's a lot of bandwidth of what that may mean. And so I'm not a gold standard guy and I'm not an end the Fed guy, but I am a reasonably rules-based Fed guy. But even that comes down to my view of work and productivity. I think that we put downward pressure on economic growth when we misallocate resources, and I think we misallocate resources by distorting the price of capital. Policy-wise on the work front, most of the things I could say that are relevant right now are policies I'd oppose. The 32-hour work week that suddenly came back in the news recently with Bernie Sanders. I joked on Twitter, I think a lot of people are going to be mad because they don't want to have to start to work 32 hours. Like getting up to 32 hours is going to throw a lot of his people off. But I think that minimum wage laws are a wonderful example. Not, you know, Milton Friedman used to talk about them as a war on minorities, and particularly inner city black kids. I would just argue right now, minimum wage laws have more or less been a total war on teenage employment.
Yeah.
And it's all in a state like California with $23 an hour minimum wage at fast food restaurants. There's just absolutely no chance they're going to hire a 16-year-old kid to work part-time at the drive-thru or sweep the floors or whatnot. And so there's a policy example where we're more or less dooming a future 24-year-old to have his first job be when he's 24 or she is 24, where they've never had a boss they didn't like, they've never had to show up on time, they've never had conflicts with coworkers, some of the just basic life skills that come about working in some of the types of jobs you and I were talking about that we had in our teenage years. I can't think of much lower hanging fruit to at least help this particular aspect of the labor market than to facilitate teenage employment. It isn't just the policy realm. I don't think a lot of kids want to work, and I don't think a lot of parents want their kids working. This whole celebration of it's good for them to focus on their studies, or the fact that they sometimes are in sports leagues that require like 36 hours a day of work, would throw off a lot of the current cultural moment. But teenage employment is one that has a policy prescription. The retirement side I see almost entirely as cultural. There will be fiscal reasons that not if, but when the retirement age is moved higher. But I would not suggest moving the retirement age higher as it pertains to Social Security benefits because I don't like the concept of retirement. My argument is not fiscal. I would just make a general sort of existential case that if I believe God made us to be productive and have purpose, that a working for the purpose of not working anymore has not gone well. And I do not believe that a baby boomer spending the last 25 years of their life in an extended vacation is a fulfilling end to one's life.
Yeah. I know you've got a kind of hard out coming up, but I wanted to ask you one last question. A question I like to ask people because I think it's always very illuminating. Tell me a little about the worst job you ever had.
I was only there a couple months. I think that after basketball season ended my senior year, where, you know, if you played sports, you had to leave a job because you weren't going to be available for a few months. Then I come back. And I was waiting for a job at the sandwich shop that I really wanted to work at. But in the meantime, I needed some spending money and the sandwich shop job didn't open up for a few months. And it was called Payless Shoe Source. Do you remember?
I remember Payless. Yeah, they're still around, I think.
Are they?
Yeah.
But let's put it this way. They're not around in Newport Beach or Fifth Avenue.
Well, you live in pretty fancy places.
But having to like stock the shoes and get the colors right and the way it was sort of organized, it like there was nothing intuitive about it for me. And for whatever reason, the job was not, and I'm a pretty OCD guy, but I was just terrible and did not have the passion for footwear necessary to excel in that job. I had a passion for concessions at the movie theater, but not Payless Shoe Source.
Passion for footwear.
Yeah.
Subject to a whole different podcast, maybe one of these days. But David, thank you so much for your time. I enjoyed the conversation. I know you've got a lot of stuff to get to today, so I appreciate you making time for us. And hope we'll do this again sometime.
I appreciate it, Kevin. Enjoyed it very much.
Thanks. That concludes our most recent episode of How the World Works. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with David Bounson. I thought it was a fun one. There'll be a link in the show notes to the entire episode on YouTube, which you can watch if you are so inclined. We'll be back next month with a new episode. Thank you.